students return to class this morning at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, but when will life get back to some sort of normal, and what will that normal be? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. It was only a half day, and students are not back to their regular curriculum. It may take some time before that happens. We'll hear from a Stoneman Douglas student about what it was like to step back on campus. Also, the city of Coral Gables is defying a state law that forbids local governments to pass gun legislation. Yesterday, the city commission unanimously approved an assault weapons ban. We'll hear from the mayor, who is challenging Tallahassee. Finally, a little bit of American influence gets into Cuba, officially. But one all-American sport has taken some of the island's youth by storm. Skateboarding. We'll talk with the director of a film called Havana Skate Days, coming to Miami this week. All of that coming up on Sundial today. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, that was some of what welcomed students back to Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School today as they got back to school exactly 2 weeks after the tragic shooting that left 17 dead and more than a dozen injured. We've heard from some of the students that it's going to be some time before they can actually get back to their studies, back to a regular day-to-day classwork curriculum. And we're going to hear from another student coming up shortly. But first, we spoke this morning with WLRN's Katie Switalski, who was at the school when everybody showed up.
It's a pretty emotional day. Some of the kids were clearly not happy to be back, but looking forward to starting this healing process and seeing their friends. Lots of parents were dropping kids off, but a lot of community members were out here. There was a local church that was here singing as the kids walked in. There were lots of therapy dogs outside, a few therapy ponies. And the kids really were, somewhat very somber. It was chaotic. So understandably, the kids are trying to avoid all the chaos out here between law enforcement and media. But, some were definitely looking happy to see their teachers and friends again.
And you talk about law enforcement. There was a much heavier law enforcement presence today.
Yes, definitely. So staying good on their promise, the Broward County Sheriff's Office and local police have been here at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas in a much heavier way. Some are guarding the school with rifles, Sheriff Scott Israel had said that would happen. That was true today. And then down the street at the elementary school, there was also an increased police presence. So on every street corner, at every point, there's a police car and officers here. And a lot of them were greeting the kids on their way back inside, giving them hugs, telling them, we're glad you're back.
And did the sheriff say anything about how long he's going to have that increased presence? At what point does he start to scale that back?
We don't know that yet. It is clear that there will be increased security at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas in some capacity for the remainder of the school year. Superintendent Robert Runcie said, the increased security to a certain extent will be there sort of permanently for the foreseeable future.
Obviously, on a day like today, the media presence will also be great, I'd imagine. How are they handling the press, and where do they have you guys basically hanging out?
It can be overwhelming to see all of the press here, and nobody wants to get in students' faces. So the press are across the street, catty corner to the school. So we're on a separate street corner, not interfering with the kids going in and out of school at all.
Obviously, they want to keep the kids separate from everything. But I think you guys had the chance to at least talk to some parents this morning, right?
Yes. WLRN's intern Leslie Ovalle did get to speak with a dad this morning, an MSD dad. And he was saying he's really proud of what these students have done. And he really hopes that they can get some gun laws changed. And he's a big advocate for more gun control. So he was saying it's a sad, pretty emotional day for his whole family. But this is the first step to getting back to normal.
Now, we've heard from students, we've heard from different people that they're not going to get back to normal yet. They're not going to be doing actual classes. The curriculum isn't set yet. They're just going to try to get everybody back and at least comfortable with being on campus. But I mean, what have you heard about, you know, what's going to happen for at least the rest of the week, the next couple of weeks?
So right now, at least for the rest of this week, the school is far more concerned with the students' well-being. There's counselors on site every day. And the half days, so today's a half day, but the half days will continue for the rest of the week. And there's no penalty for kids who are still feeling overwhelmed and, you know, are absent. The school understands that that's going to happen, and that's probably going to be increased for a little while. So as students, you know, feel like they can come back, they're encouraged to, but there's not this pressure that they have to be back or they will get an absence. And the school district is looking to reach out to families who, you know, the students don't feel ready to come back yet. They're still scared. They're still overwhelmed. And the school district is looking to see how they can sort of individually provide what these students need.
And again, this is 2 weeks to the day of the shooting. Were there any special ceremonies or, did the school, the students do anything special, in remembrance of what happened?
I don't know that. They could be doing something inside the school. I do know outside there's still that huge wall of signs from other schools, flowers, teddy bears, balloons. There's still this large homage to all the victims, the big memorial outside. And, you know, lots of community members just came to show support for these kids, singing, you know, "This Little Light of Mine," and trying to give these kids as much positivity as possible, as much strength as possible before going back to what's a scary place for a lot of them still.
Again, talking with WLRN's Katie Switalski at Stoneman Douglas High School today as students return to class 2 weeks after that tragic shooting where 17 people lost their lives. Katie, thank you so much for the time.
Thanks, Lewis.
And just to note that actually during that interview, Broward County School Superintendent Robert Runcie was holding a press conference, and I got some information on that. Runcie had mentioned that 95% of students showed up today, were in attendance today. 150 counselors were also on hand. And so far, 15 of the more than 3,000 students have asked for transfer information to try to move to a different school. Again, that press conference started at 1 o'clock and I believe still going on right now. I want to turn things over now to one of the students from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. We spoke to him before and you've seen him in the news. He has been one of the faces, one of the voices that has spoken up about gun issues and gun violence, especially in schools. I want to bring him back now, David Hogg. He is a senior and one of the voices behind the Never Again movement. David, it's a pleasure to talk to you again.
Pleasure to talk to you.
You know what? What was it like for you this morning when you woke up and you knew you had to go back to school today?
It wasn't emotional. I didn't really feel anything, to be quite honest with you. It was just, I have to do this. I have to get back and I have to continue learning because you got to remember, like, I still have to graduate high school, you know?
Yeah, because you are a senior. This is your final year. I want to get to what comes next for you. But again, as you're getting back on campus, I mean, we heard a little bit from our reporter about what she saw. But as you're getting back on campus and you're walking around, I mean, what was that like? What kind of stuff were you talking about with your friends and classmates? And what were the teachers talking about?
To be honest, it was obviously a lot of emotional stuff, talking about, like, remembering the people. And just everything, remembering the people, trying to process some of the emotions that were going on, but also acknowledging the fact that we have to continue fighting and we have to continue fighting on. And I think what's important, the big thing for me was that I initially felt sad when I started walking into the school, but once I started seeing all the banners that people had sent, once I started seeing all the therapy dogs and everything like that, I didn't feel scared or sad. I felt impassioned and I felt loved, because that's really what this country is doing, is coming together.
And I want to ask you about the people from all over the country who also have reached out to you and to the other students. I want to go back to, you were in Tallahassee recently, and I wanted to know, who did you meet with?
I didn't meet with anyone, actually, because my flight was delayed. so I couldn't get there on time. The only thing I was really able to do there was speak with some reporters from multiple news organizations. So we did, when we were in Tallahassee, we had a day chock full of different meetings with legislators. Only one Republican lawmaker met with us. All the others canceled because they want citizens of Florida to forget about this. They want to continue on to have this their session, get it over with, and get reelected. That's what they want. There's a reason why Rick Scott is implementing all of these new legislation things a year from now and not today. It's not because he can't do it today. It's not because he can't do it tomorrow. It's because he wants it to happen right around his election for Senate. Why do you think he's calling out Bill Nelson? It's because he wants his Senate seat, and he's trying to turn this tragedy into a political pawn for himself.
All right, so I want to make sure that you made it to Tallahassee, or you didn't.
I did make it to Tallahassee.
Okay.
My flight was delayed.
I see.
But
I see.
We weren't able to meet with basically any legislators except for a few.
Okay, and that was last week, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, who was the lawmaker you were able to talk to? Who was the one person who spoke with you?
It was a lawmaker. She was a woman from Miami, I believe. I didn't get to speak with her, but my different members of the movement were able to speak with her. I went in the state house and tried talking to some people, but by then, because my flight was delayed, I was not really able to talk to anyone. But my friends were that were from the Never Again movement.
So what you mentioned it just a second ago. I mean, the governor has pushed forward his plan. There is a plan that lawmakers are talking about. They're looking
He's pushed forward his political agenda is what he's done, and that's what he continues to do.
All right. So, I mean, is there anything about what he's pressing forward, again, trying to raise the age for who can buy one of these kind of long guns?
Yeah, I absolutely support most of what he's pushing forward, except for I think it's called the Marshall Plan, where it's a plan to arm teachers more. I don't support that. But a majority of the stuff that he is pushing forward is a good idea. It's just he's not doing it as fast as he could because he wants it to happen right around his election for Senate.
All right. And I just to correct real quick, I thought I'd heard that he is not for arming teachers in classes, though that is a part of the plan that was pushed by lawmakers. I just want to make sure that I get that forward, because he's not here to obviously question or challenge anything that you might be saying. You've mentioned a few times that if the state doesn't pass gun laws, perhaps there should be a boycott of spring break in Florida.
There definitely should be. Notice how like they're only starting to take action now that I've threatened the entire state's economy. I love small business owners. I love the state of Florida. But I don't think that we should have people coming to our state if they're not going to be safe.
Have you heard from any lawmakers after you made that statement?
I did. I heard from multiple. I'm not going to go on the I won't say who they were.
Okay.
But I did hear from some lawmakers talking about what bills were being implemented, what they're trying to implement. And I knew that it was because of my tweet about not boycotting Florida for spring break, because they immediately asked me after, if this gets passed, will you end your boycott?
And what did you tell them?
I told them that I would if it got passed the way that they presented it to me.
Are you concerned at all that it could hurt businesses, maybe some of people you know?
Of course, but that's not my fault. That's the politicians in Florida's fault. How can we continue to send people here and allow them to be slaughtered because our politicians won't take action? They don't care about our lives. They care about money and re-election.
Beyond just tweeting that out and saying it, are you and other students, are you actively ramping up for a possible boycott to try to make that happen?
Oh, absolutely. We're disgusted at the fact that FedEx has only continued that. The fact that FedEx has only continued to support the NRA and say that they don't honestly care is disgusting. So we have to boycott them too, along with Amazon, who promotes NRA TV, which is essentially their propaganda machine. It's a lot of things that we're having to do as students and take on because our parents and our politicians won't.
Beyond that, what else are you willing to do?
Anything to save these kids' lives.
I want to ask about Washington. Other Douglas students spent the last few days in the Capitol. Who did they meet there? Do you know?
They met with Speaker Paul Ryan. They met with Bernie Sanders. They met with, they met with some civil rights activists that were, I honestly can't think of their names right now, but they were I know who they are, but they met with some very impressive, important people in American history and American politics and discussed these issues with them. I don't know if they met with Marco Rubio or not, but yeah, the fact that they're only continuing to sidestep these questions that we've, like at the town hall you saw, Cameron Cassidy asked them asked Marco Rubio a simple yes or no answer, and that question was, will you, Marco Rubio, continue to take money from the NRA? And Marco said yes in a like 5-sentence answer to try in an effort to confuse the American and Floridian public so that he can get reelected.
And I believe that John Lewis was one of the other folks that they had met with while they were up there.
That's who it was.
So what kind of gun and school safety legislation are you hoping comes out of the out of Washington?
Federal, obviously. Raising the federal age of ownership and possession to 21. Just honestly, at this point, making sure that the individuals that are mentally stable, don't have a criminal background, or are mature enough, are able to obtain a firearm and use their Second Amendment rights. We don't want to get rid of people's Second Amendment rights. We want to have limitations on the Second Amendment in the same way that there's limitations on the First. In the same way that you can't yell fire in a crowded theater, you shouldn't be able to get a weapon of mass destruction like some of these guns are and be able to just kill thousands of people because you're a mentally unstable individual or somebody with a criminal history or a history of domestic violence. This is common sense gun reform that allows people to still have their Second Amendment rights to own a firearm, but puts limitations on it so that the wrong people won't be able to own it. We're trying to make sure that the wrong people aren't able to get the guns and the right people are able to still own them if they choose.
Now, you're helping organize a march later next month at the Capitol. What's the latest on that?
Just, I'm kind of press secretary, so I haven't been really working with them on that. I just know that there's been a lot of progress. We're working extremely hard on it, and it's on March 24th.
And you're going to be up there in D.C.?
Yes, I will be up there. I will be in D.C. on March 24th, marching with my friends and marching for the 17 others that are no longer there.
Have you planned exactly where you're going to march, what you're going to be doing, and who you hope to meet?
I think we have. I was supposed to find out about that at school today, but I was so busy like talking to my teachers and catching up with them that I wasn't able to.
You know, as I mentioned before, you talked about this. I mean, a lot of people have come forward and connected with you, and I'm just wondering, you know, how many different people from what parts of the country, what parts of the world have connected with you on social media or anywhere else about this story?
I mean, pretty much everywhere. I've gotten direct messages from places like Kenya, some from Cambodia, some from basically almost every country except, like, you know, like... Basically every country except North Korea at this point. And it's pretty amazing to see the amount of support and loving kindness that the world can have in such a dark time.
And of course, you know, Oprah Winfrey and some other very big names from Hollywood said they're going to not only just help out. I mean, they want to be there at the march. They also are giving a lot of money.
Yeah.
George Clooney was one of them as well. I'm wondering about the offers from different people in different organizations. I mean, is it a situation where you're going to take anything that comes your way, or do you have to look at those offers critically?
It's a combination of both, I would say, even though that doesn't really make sense. Like, we really have to analyze it critically, though, especially given how much support we're getting, because it's almost becoming an issue that there's so many people that want to help. It's really organizing it. That's the issue that we're facing right now, and getting everybody out there to be able to help with us, making sure everybody's like registered to vote and things like that. That's really what we're trying to focus on right now, along with continuing these boycotts and helping out the individuals that need it, the families, you know.
You know, I wondered if before all of this ever happened, were you politically active?
I wasn't politically active. I would say I was somewhat politically knowledgeable because of my previous experience in speech and debate, where we had to, we literally had to argue about universal background checks on both sides for about a month. And that argument and that debate started, I want to say, 2 months ago, 3 months ago. And we were arguing about that, and that's how I knew a lot about it. And I also watched a lot of news and do a lot of research into these topics just because I think they're interesting and they're issues that affect my generation and the future of America.
So as you said, you're a senior, you're going to be graduating, and I'm wondering, yeah. I mean, do you expect to continue working on these issues even after Douglas High? I mean, you got college
Absolutely.
All set and everything?
Well, no, I've only been accepted to Florida Atlantic University. I, in fact, got rejected by Cal State Long Beach the day after the shooting. I actually woke up to an email from them saying that. But at this point, I think I'm probably going to take a gap year and then apply to Harvard for political science and Northwestern for journalism, because I want to be on the campaign trail helping win elections on both sides, working on a candidate basis, not just for parties, but working for each candidate that supports the agenda that we put forth, and that's just one that asserts that we don't take people's Second Amendment rights. We put limitations on it to ensure that the majority of people are not punished by this. It's the minority of people that shouldn't own guns. We're trying to make them. We're trying to make it so that they can obtain these weapons. You know. So yeah.
David Hogg, again, is a senior at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. He is one of the voices behind the Never Again movement, and they are planning a march on D.C. later next month. David, again, it's a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Nice to talk to you, too.
All right, still to come, we're going to talk to a South Florida mayor who just got an assault weapons ban passed in his city. But is the state going to let him do that? It's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, the city of Coral Gables just voted to break the law. It's a state law that forbids local governments from passing gun legislation. Yesterday, the Coral Gables Commission voted to do exactly that and unanimously passed a ban on assault weapons. We're going to talk now with Coral Gables Mayor Raul Valdez Fowley. Mayor, the citywide ban, this was your idea. Why did you think it was necessary?
This was my idea because I think it was necessary to send a message to Tallahassee, our capital, saying that we need to protect our children. I mean, these assault weapons have been used in the past to attack schools, to kill kids, many, many in Florida. And we wanted to send a message to Tallahassee that in spite of it being sanctioned being prohibited by the legislature and exposing ourselves to a $5,000 fine, and removal from office by the governor, I guess, or the legislature. We wanted to send a message. We wanted to send a message and dare them to do something to protect our kids. So we passed this law banning assault weapons in Coral Gables.
Were you surprised that the entire Coral Gables Commission agreed with you?
There were four members present, and I was very pleased that the entire commission and the message is that, you know, we need to do something. I mean, it is against the law, against the state law, but it is a law that bans anybody from doing anything about guns. And we thought it was the time to do something, to send a message to Tallahassee and to dare them to act. That's the message.
As you mentioned, this is a state law. This is passed back in 2011 that forbids municipalities to do exactly what you just did yesterday.
Yeah, yeah.
What are the penalties that you and the other commissioners are now threatened with?
The penalties are $5,000 fine, which can't be paid by the city or with tax funds, and removal from office. And I'm sure that the NRA is not going to let this stand, and they will take a stand, and maybe I'll be removed from office, or maybe I'll pay the fine. I'll pay the fine, and that's not a problem. But we needed to protect our kids. We needed to send them a message that these weapons are weapons of mass destruction, and they are used to kill children in the state of Florida. And we wanted to do something about it.
What did your city attorney advise you to do when you first brought this up?
Our city attorney was shocked that I brought this up. And she said, it's illegal. And I said, I don't care. Let's pass it. And then we'll deal with the legalities of it afterwards. But again, it is the message that we have to protect our children. The city attorney didn't like it at all. No.
And she's forbidden by state law from defending you.
She's forbidden by state law from defending us, and the fine has to be paid out of our own funds. The taxpayers' funds can't be used for it. No.
And as you mentioned, the governor has the right. He could remove you from office. He could remove the commissioners. Are you ready for that? Are you prepared for what could come next?
I am prepared for what can come next. I think the governor is also aware of the problems that assault weapons cause, and he has said that no children or no young men or women under 21 can buy these, but we don't want assault weapons in our city, and I'm prepared for whatever happens. Yeah.
Again, I'm sorry.
The message, what we did has been extremely popular in the city of Coral Gables, and I'm prepared for whatever comes.
Yeah. Well, let me get to that. I wanted to ask you what have you heard from residents? How many residents were at the meeting? But also, have you heard from residents around your city? How do they feel about the fact that you've done this and that, again, you could be removed from office?
The residents are very, very positive about what happened. I mean, I've received 50 messages and 50 calls and everything, and 49 of them have been positive, and one has been very mentioning the Second Amendment and such. Second Amendment has nothing at all to do with weapons of mass destruction, with assault rifles. But they're almost unanimously positive.
Again, I'm talking with Coral Gables Mayor Raul Valdez-Fali. We're talking about the fact that last night the city commission voted unanimously to pass a ban on assault weapons. Again, this is illegal because the state law says no municipality can do this. This is on the state,
right,
not the municipalities. So do you think you could prevail in court?
I think we have a chance in court. I mean, this may be seen as freedom of expression. You know, we passed an ordinance to express our dissatisfaction with what's happening. Maybe we'll get there, but the message was sent, and I'm very pleased with that.
Well, it was a few weeks ago that the city of Tallahassee challenged this 2011 ban, and they lost in court.
That's distinguishable. I mean, I think that case is distinguishable, and we're ready for whatever it is. And if we lose in court, they'll take us to court. But I'm in this, in this program, but we publicized that we're not in agreement with what's happening with Florida kids and assault rifles.
And you said a moment ago that you're fine with paying those fines. All the commissioners are okay if they have to pay their own fines and they have to pay for their own legal.
That's fine. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're willing to do that. We're willing to do that. And because we have sent our message, and I think it's been very well received in the city of Coral Gables.
What happens if the governor tries to remove you from office? What are you going to do?
The governor is the governor, and he'll remove you from office, and then I don't know what to do. I haven't reached that yet, but if I run again in the next election, I will prevail, I'm sure.
Are there many gun sales within the city limits of Coral Gables?
No, there aren't. No, there aren't. There aren't many gun sales, there aren't, no.
So since this 2011 law, do you think there are more guns in the city now because of the change of the state law?
Coral Gables residents have guns. I mean, Coral Gables residents, I believe in the Second Amendment. I believe in that. But I don't believe in these assault rifles. And I think that, many people in Coral Gables have weapons and legal weapons and everything. But as I say, I don't think anybody should have an assault rifle in the city of Coral Gables.
So just to make clear, too, by the way, this isn't the last step regarding this ban in Coral Gables. I mean, what has to happen next for you guys?
I don't know. I think the next move is up to the governor or up to the legislature. We passed it, and, we passed it yesterday, and I'm sitting here waiting.
Yeah? Okay. Do you think there's any chance an assault weapons ban will be passed in Tallahassee?
I have no idea. I don't think our legislature is going to do it. The House committee voted 18-11 yesterday not to do anything. So that was yesterday's vote, and I don't think the House or the Senate are ready to do anything in Tallahassee. No.
What do you think about the various school safety proposals that they've debated? Do you see anything there that you might agree with? And also, what do you think about arming teachers?
I think arming teachers is, shall I call it a stupid idea? I mean, I don't want my grandson's 60-some lady teacher with a weapon. I mean, she'd shoot herself in the foot or he would shoot himself in the foot, the 60-year-old teacher, and kill two or three kids as he or she were taking the, you know, drawing the gun to fire on someone. I think it's a stupid idea.
Mayor, do you feel that the school children in Coral Gables are safe?
I feel that I don't have an answer to that. I felt the ones of the Stoneman Douglas kids, they were safe until this happened. You know, they were safe until this happened. You never know how many crazy kids are out there, with, or kids or young adults or whatever, with assault rifles, and they're safe until something happens.
Have you heard from any other mayors or city leaders from around South Florida?
I have heard from two mayors, and they're very supportive of what we did. I don't know whether they're going to do anything, but they're very supportive.
Can you tell me who they were?
No, I can't. Yeah.
Do you think any other city, any other city commission mayor is going to try to do what you did?
I think they will. I mean, what I've heard is that everybody's been very, very supportive in Coral Gables and outside of Coral Gables, and I hope that they do something for Tallahassee to realize that this is a very serious movement to protect our kids. Yeah.
There were city commissioners in Weston. They instructed their legal department to take Florida to court over this 2011 restriction. And the mayor, Daniel Sturmer, said that he's urging other cities and counties across Florida to join in the suit in an effort to lift those sanctions. Is that something that you would be interested in?
We would be very interested in that, yes. Very interested in that, yeah. But we decided to take go a step further and challenge that directly.
Let me finish with this. Mayor, again, if the governor decides in the coming weeks or months that he's going to remove you, what will you do at that point? Are you ready to step down right away?
At that point, I will be removed, and then I will campaign for what I believe is right, which is the rights of our children not to be assaulted, not to be threatened with these assault rifles. And there will be an election a year and 2 months from now, and let's see what happens then.
Again,
the governor removes it, the government removes it. There's nothing I can do about it, but you know, I hope that doesn't happen.
Again, I've been talking with Coral Gables Mayor Raul Valdez-Fali. He pressed for this at the beginning. He wanted an assault weapons ban in the city of Coral Gables. Last night, the city commission voted unanimously for that. Again, that's against the law. The state passed its own law in 2011, not allowing municipalities to do this. What will happen next? We're going to follow this story. Mayor, it's been a pleasure. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much for having me on your program. Thank you.
All right. Bye. Again, a story we're going to keep following on that one. And when the governor, if the governor would do anything, well, we'll let you know. All right. Still to come, creating a skateboarding community in Cuba. That's coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, tomorrow night at O Cinema in Wynwood, they're showing a film about an unlikely American sport starting to take root in Cuba. Skateboarding. It's big business in the U.S. The X Games have become part of the fabric of sports for us here in this country, so much so that skateboarding and surfing are going to be added to the 2020 Tokyo Olympics. The film is called Havana Skate Days, co-directed by Christopher Rios and Julian Mora Basque. It follows the story of a number of young Cubans trying to bring that skate culture to their country, and that includes this one young man, Yojani Perez. But here's a clip from the film.
So this is our second Go Skateboarding Day celebration. When we first got here, there was maybe 25 people skating in Havana. Over the past 5 years, that oldest generation that at that time when we first started coming was teenagers, all grew up to be the leaders of this movement. So all the leaders have gotten to a certain age to where they want to better their lives. And little by little, all those leaders have been going to different countries, some of them not returning. And it has changed the dynamics of skateboarding here because the guys that are skating right now that are, let's say, 13, 14 years old, don't remember what it's like not to have people like us helping.
All right. Well, joining me now in studio, one of the filmmakers, Chris Rios. Christopher Rios, but Chris, you go by Chris.
Yeah,
Chris, it's a pleasure to have you, man. Thanks so much.
No, my pleasure.
It was a fun film, and something that really jumped out at me, I didn't even think about it, is, I mean, look, I was a kid with a skateboard, wasn't a good skater, by the way. But I just thought, well, that's kind of just what being a kid is, right? At some point you get a skateboard, you go out, at least you're playing with it for a little bit. But it's very different in Cuba. How would you describe that skate culture and how skating got into Cuba?
Well, the story behind how skating got into Cuba is there's no it's sort of a creation myth that no one really has the right answer to, and it's a long story. But one of our characters in our film, Che Pando, he was sort of the one who's been credited as being the godfather of skate in Cuba. Maybe not the one who brought skate to Cuba, but the one who's really kept it alive over, you know, the decades and kept it alive in a way where, you know, there's just certain things that are not accessible. Maybe now a little bit more, now that there's a little bit more travel between the U.S. and Cuba. But back then when he was skating in, you know, the late 80s, the early 90s, they really were working with what they had, a lo cubano, as is the phrase. And so Che is the one who's really credited as the one really kind of helping the culture to take root. What we document in our film is, I mean, yes, it is skateboarding, but it's also about youth in Cuba at a very particular time. But the period of time in the history of skateboarding that we document is sort of from, you know, early 2000, you know, well, not early, 2013, right, through pretty much 2017. And at that point, skate had gone through ebbs and flows in Cuba. There were periods where, you know, this is from the skaters themselves, stories that they've told us. There were periods where they felt that it seemed like everyone was on the street skating. And, you know, you can see almost any young person on a board. And that had a lot to do with maybe at that particular time it was easy to get the material, but also, you know, there was a really tight-knit group that was kind of calling each other out and you know, having them come out into the streets and skate around.
How did you find this story? How did this film, you know, I guess, really begin to form for you?
I give that credit to my co-director, Julian. He went out with one of the NGOs that we feature in the film, Cuba Skate, and Miles Jackson, who's the founder and co-founder and executive director. He went out with them on a trip in 2013 and just sort of went to see what there was to see. And when he came back, he stitched together a little bit of a Kickstarter to see if there was any interest in getting support for a documentary. And it came across my inbox because of an old friend from high school who passed it along. What was really striking for me, why I was interested in it, and why I thought it was a good story to tell, is sort of what these skaters represented and what they were saying in between. You know, skate is just sort of the metaphor, right? It could be art, it could be photography, it could be any other medium that, you know, that young people in Cuba are into. But what they were really saying is that there's this future that they're trying to imagine, and it's very uncertain. You know, that's even more true now than it was when we first started filming.
Skating may be the most apropos though in this situation, because the skater culture, at least, you know, look, and I'm making this from experience growing up as a kid here in the U.S. is that it's a little bit rebellious. It's a rebellious culture.
Yeah.
And not one that, you know, parents and cops like much, or at least when I was growing up, that was the case. And so did that say a lot about the youth in Cuba right now, about where they are? Are they rebelling against the culture?
Well, I don't want to speak for them, but, you know, I think one of the great things about the film is that we let our, you know, the people that we followed along, we let them speak for themselves. And I think their actions actually speak a lot louder than what they say. There's a lot that's unsaid, especially when you're out there, right? I don't know if they're rebelling, but I do know that they want more. They want something different. And you can see that, you know, I know that just, for example, when we first started filming in 2013, there were a lot of skaters out in the street, and it seemed like a huge community. And over the couple of years of filming, a lot of the skaters started showing up in, you know, Florida, start showing up in Arizona, start showing up in Spain. They started leaving because they felt like they were running up against, there's something about where they're at right now, what they imagine their Cuba to be, that doesn't quite fit with, I guess, the image that Cuba is projecting. And I'll say that, you know, I'm not Cuban, you know, and I know, obviously I know the history of Cuba. I don't want to step in anything, but this is just what I know from my experience. And this is what I've seen from my time out there.
Again, I'm talking with Chris Rios. He's one of the co-directors of the film Havana Skate Days, a beautiful documentary looking at this skating culture in Cuba with this young generation in Cuba right now. And where are they taking it? Where are they trying to take it? By the way, the film is going to be playing at O Cinema in Wynwood this week. We'll have information on our website, WLRN.org. Was it difficult getting in? It seemed at times, I'm watching this film, it had that guerrilla style filming. You had to be very careful, very sometimes secretive. It seemed that way, but I mean, because it's Cuba. I mean, did you have a hard time getting equipment in, filming, talking to people?
Yeah, we first imagined that we'd be able to go down there with a bunch of cameras and really have a really high, you know, value in production. And honestly, that doesn't fit the skate aesthetic. It's, you know, skate aesthetic is, like you mentioned, very DIY, very kind of guerrilla. So I think that would have been the wrong approach anyway. But also just practically, we just couldn't. You really couldn't go in there with, you know, big expensive cameras. You really couldn't be skating around with really flashy gear. You had to sort of, I don't want to say be clandestine, but just, you know, not draw attention to yourself.
Did you run into any issues?
Yeah, you know, toward the end, there were some situations, especially when we were trying to fly drones and things like that, where, you know, we were permitted and everything, so it was all cool on paper, but, you know, the authorities really don't want you flying drones for all the reasons that you can imagine. So, yeah, there was a few situations where we did get stopped and we had to sort of show the paperwork and go through the bureaucracy and kind of, you know, it took hours, but we ultimately were fine. But I think that also to that point, part of the reason why we were able to get so much, I don't want to give anything away, but there are some scenes where, you know, I think we are talking to government officials. We are talking to people that that are representing the state, right? I think part of the reason we were able to get that material is because they, you know, from the position of the sort of, you know, I don't want to say adults, but from the position of, you know, the state.
Well, the authority.
The authorities,
the state.
Yeah. They don't really take these skaters seriously, whereas these skaters really feel like they're professional athletes.
There's an interesting part of this, and we'll get to it in a minute, because I'm going to, without giving a lot away, you're mm-hmm. right. There's an interesting point in the movie where, as you said, it almost seemed like the state kind of felt it was a joke.
Yeah.
Because again, as I mentioned, skateboarding now is going to be part of the 2020 Tokyo Olympics. There's an effort, or there was an effort, or there was discussion in Cuba of possibly putting a team together or having, you know, any Cubans representing in those Olympics for skateboarding?
There was, yeah. And I think that, you know, that's when our main character, Yohani, he was really excited because he sees himself as not just a kid skating in the street, but as an athlete. And he really wants to grow extreme sports in Cuba. Not, you know, he says it in the film, not just skateboarding, but surfing, you know, all sorts of extreme sports. And so this was an opportunity for him and his community to actually show that they are serious and that they're the real deal. And, you know, Cuba really does value Olympic sports. So there was conversation between the INDER, which is the sports authority in Cuba, and the skate community to see if they can put together a skateboarding team.
How do just Cubans in general view skateboarding and skaters? You know, you see these guys, these kids rolling up and down the streets on their skateboards, and it, just like here in the U.S., you know, every now and then they're jumping up and doing some tricks here and there, tricks off the sidewalk and other things like that. Please don't ask me to even tell you what those tricks are named, because I wasn't that good. But, you know, how do just regular everyday Cubans view skaters? Because there was a great scene, by the way. Was it Yohani's mother?
Yeah, his grandmother.
Yeah. I mean, there's a great scene between the two of them. And I kind of got a sense of, you know, at least what the older generations kind of think of skaters.
Yeah. So, you know, I think before it was less common. Now there are a lot of skaters, and especially in the hipper parts of Havana. There are a lot of skaters on the streets, partially through the efforts of Amigo Skate and Cuba Skate, who are bringing skateboards into the country. And other NGOs as well. But, you know, it's more accessible.
Non-government organizations, right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think before it was way less common and people were just kind of like, these kids are, you know, they're out of their mind. You know, what are they doing? They're on these boards with wheels. You know, they're weird. And that's just sort of everyday regular folks that are on the street. Now, because, you know, these guys do these big events like Go Skateboarding Day. They do these big skate events and they are more prominent and they're, you know, and people have seen them. I think it's just something that people kind of get, but they, you know, they feel like it's a cool thing to do, but they quite don't really understand where that fits in sort of, you know, the everyday sort of Cuban society. It's not like, you know, musicians playing on the, you know, on El Malecón or anything like that.
You talked about one, you just mentioned a group from here in mm-hmm. South Florida, I believe in Kendall, a group that's trying to get gear and equipment, skateboards to Cuba, called Amigo Skate Cuba.
Yeah,
is that what it is?
Amigo Skate. Yeah.
You know, so you follow this group a little bit as they're bringing stuff down there. I mean, is it hard for Cubans, young Cubans especially, to get skateboards or at least the equipment to build their own skateboards?
Yeah, I mean, even now where we have these groups going more frequently. Because the, you know, the relationships have eased a little bit, the tensions have eased a little bit between the two countries. It still is very difficult to get a hold of the materials, not just the skateboards, but the trucks, the wheels, all, you know, the grip tape, all these things that you need that you can just go into a store anywhere here in the States and get. Those things aren't readily available. So if your board breaks, or, you know, if anything, if you lose your trucks, or if you lose your wheels, or if you even lose the tools that you need to mount all the stuff onto the board, you're looking at maybe a couple days, if not weeks, of being able to skate, you know, before you find a replacement, or maybe months, right? If you're not one of these really great skaters that are in Havana that are usually the first ones to get gear, you might wait a while before one of the groups comes down and brings you boards, or someone gives you a hand-me-down, or you're able to find something just to skate around on.
Another part of the film that was interesting is that there was another group from the U.S. helping in trying to build a big skate park.
Yeah.
Has that ever happened? What did happen with it?
You know, we were hoping that was going to be a bigger story point in our film. There was a lot of expectation that it would come to pass, that, you know, because the government was interested in supporting the sport because it's now in the Olympics. And the people who have the expertise to do all that, you know, all that work to make a proper skate park, a park where, you know, kids will not get hurt or it won't be as dangerous as it normally is, you know, and the concrete is the right, you know, smoothness, and you have all the ramps and stuff like that to do the tricks. All those folks are over here. So obviously, you know, a lot of these NGOs that are bringing down the materials, these non-governmental organizations that are bringing down the materials to Cuba, obviously, they were the ones who were brokering those deals. But it just sort of got caught up in the bureaucracy. And it, ultimately, what it ended up doing was getting the hopes up of a lot of the folks in our film, a lot of the characters, a lot of folks that you don't see, a lot of the skaters out, you know, out and about, you know, like on the street. They were really excited for it. And because it never happened, you know, it's just more of the same, that they've experienced, you know.
One of the characters in the film, again, the gentleman who runs the group out of Kendall, Rene LaCour,
I hope I'm saying that right.
Something he said really interesting in the brief time that we have left. He doesn't think skating is going to catch on in Cuba. It's just not Cuba's thing. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I don't want to speak for Rene. He has strong opinions. But I think he is touching on something that is important. And I think... It's important not just for the skate scene, but for any kind of, you know, let's say millennial, you know, like sport or millennial kind of thing. There's just a disconnect between the old way of doing things and this future where people like our main characters in the film are uniquely positioned to sort of help usher Cuba into this new future, this uncertain future, because they get media. They get the outside world. They're connected in ways that no one in Cuba has ever been connected before, not just physically to the internet, but also to people who are coming in and bringing them stuff and, you know, bringing them ideas. And yet this old way, people who think of things in this sort of old way and who do things in this old way, they don't see them as legitimate and they don't see them as part of Cuban society. And that right there, I think, is the tension that we were really trying to highlight in the film.
Fascinating film. It's called Havana Skate Days. It is playing tomorrow night at O Cinema in Wynwood. Again, we'll have more information on our website. Talking with Chris Rios, one of the co-directors of the film. Again, this idea of bringing skateboard culture to Cuba, will they embrace it the same way that it is here in the United States and other parts of the world? Chris, it's been a pleasure, man. Thanks so much. And that's the program for today. We really appreciate you listening. I'm Luis Hernandez. We'll talk tomorrow.